Good morning, I'm Tate Westendorf here today on behalf of Bronson Cunningham. The issue in this case is pretty straightforward. It's only one assignment of error. Whether the evidence was sufficient to prove that Mr. Cunningham had concealed was a magnetic tank bag.
Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Thank you for reminding me. If I could, 3 minutes.
Sure.
So it's a tank bag. It's got magnets on it. It's for motorcyclists. It attaches to the fuel tank. So this took place at Walmart. Pretty basic facts. He enters the Walmart. Loss prevention sees him looking at this box with the tank bag. He takes it out of the box. That makes them suspicious. They start following him. He's got it in his hand. It's visible. He's also holding a separate backpack that he had also selected. And he enters a bathroom. As he exits the bathroom, loss prevention testifies, we can still see the larger backpack, but we can't see this tank bag. Puts the backpack down in this area reserved for, you know, items that customers have decided to discard and not purchase. And then as he's leaving the store, they confront him. Coincidentally, a Virginia Beach police officer, Officer Shank, is also entering the store at that point.
And, well, let me ask you this, sure. Mr. Westendorf. We're familiar with the facts. We think of this crime as shoplifting, but its formal title is concealment. And from a sufficiency standpoint, the crime is arguably complete when it's concealed, when the item is concealed from both the owner and the public. I mean, we're talking about, you know, you don't actually have to leave the store, in other words, to be guilty of the crime of concealment. If you take an item off the shelf and hide it behind stock or, you know, put it in a trash can somewhere or whatever, you're effectively depriving the owner of the property, the store, the opportunity to sell it to somebody, and then the crime is over and done with at that point. Why isn't this evidence sufficient from that kind of an analysis? We know he possessed it. He took it out of the box. He's still in the store. We don't know exactly where it is. It was never recovered, but he did, which arguably suggests he did a heck of a job concealing it because they still haven't been able to find it.
I do agree that we should laser focus on the issue of whether the evidence is sufficient to prove the concealment. I think that the Commonwealth had a little bit of trouble with the charging decision in this one. The amendment or the indictment was amended from petty third to concealment third. So I agree that's the issue. One, I mean, there's certainly no direct evidence that he concealed the item. The loss prevention officers both testify, you know, we never saw him put it in his pockets, down his pants, anything like that. I think it's also not in dispute that the item's never recovered. They never find it anywhere in the store. When he fled the store, the officer had tried to chase him. Just kind of to add some color to it, it's not in the record, but
Mr. So you can certainly draw, the fact finder can certainly draw some reasonable inferences here. He took it out of the box, put the box, empty box back on the shelf, and kept the contents until he disappeared. And the next time he's seen on video, the contents of the box are nowhere to be seen. And then when he's confronted, he flees, which of course is a factor that can goes to his state of mind and so forth. So, I mean, again, that plus what I indicated earlier, I'm just struggling to understand how, as a matter of law, this evidence is insufficient, given that, you don't have to find the property to have a completed concealment offense.
Well, just kind of taking up the issues you identified one at a time, with the flight, of course, like the case I cited, Wong Sun, which I know is more commonly cited as the fruit of the poisonous tree case, but it also has language in there about the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently doubted the probative value of flight. And I think for good reason, people flee from the police
so
for all
Virginia
sorts
law
of different
makes it
reasons.
Pretty clear flight is a factor that can be considered.
It can be considered, but there's also case law saying that you have to establish that there's a nexus between the flight and consciousness of guilt because you've committed the crime. In this case, the only evidence that was presented at trial as far as why he fled was Officer Shank testified, well, when I finally caught up with Mr. Cunningham, he had said something along the lines of, I thought these loss prevention officers were associated with my ex-girlfriend who was stalking me, and that's why I ran.
But the trier of fact is free to disbelieve parts of the evidence.
And of course, he didn't say it.
I thought the Wong Song site was very creative. But there have been some more recent Supreme Court cases that have said a long flight is evidence
right,
consistent
right.
with guilt. So,
I mean, it's
good.
I appreciate that.
I appreciate your creativity on that.
To the point where it might be a suspicious circumstance that he took the item out of the box. Maybe suspicious, maybe not. I don't think it's
Of course, as with any circumstantial case,
right.
You can isolate individual facts and say, yeah, there might be another explanation. But you put them all together, and it's not. Sometimes 2 and 2 actually does equal 4. You know,
it's definitely a totality of the circumstances analysis. I think an important factor for the court to consider is the fact that when he flees the store. They catch up to him in pretty short order, and he's found in this pawn shop that's only half a block away from the Walmart. Canine dogs have been used to track him. Nowhere along that relatively short path is this tank bag found. Officer Shank testified, I never saw him discard any items as he was fleeing. It's not on his person when he's arrested. And the conversation he has with Officer Shank when Mr. Cunningham's advised, we suspect you might have been involved in a shoplifting. He says, well, no, the item's back in the store. Take me back to the store, and I'll show you where it is.
This could have also accounted for why it was a concealment, why it was amended to concealment as opposed to petty larceny.
Well, but again, he's not admitting by that statement that I've concealed the item.
No, but how do you address, rather than get around, how do you address the fact that an employee sees him carry the item into the store restroom, walk out of the store restroom, not carrying the item?
They described it as being a small item. Even prior to entering the restroom, they said that it was partially concealed by this larger backpack that he was also carrying. So I think it's reasonable. A reasonable theory could be that they just couldn't see it.
See, that brings us to a point that the parties, you know, we asked the parties to address. The parties say we don't need to address it, but we've got this video that we can't view. And you know, the parties have said, oh, well, you don't need to view it. The problem is, this is a sufficiency argument, and that was part of the evidence that the trial court found sufficient. And if we can't view it, if we can't make an independent judgment as to, you know, whether it supports or doesn't support the Commonwealth's position, you know, we understand that you're asserting that it just doesn't matter. But it seems to me, since it's your obligation as the appellant to provide us with the record, you know, and plus, frankly, it's disturbing to me that we have a situation where trial courts are accepting as evidence exhibits that cannot be viewed by appellate courts, or for that matter, the public, because these things become public records once they're admitted into evidence at a clerk's office. So, I mean, from several standpoints, it seems to me that puts you at a disadvantage. But you say we don't need to address it. But again, you're describing facts, the totality of the circumstances. Part of those circumstances is what's on the video from the loss prevention department of the Walmart here, and you know, you tell us what it does and doesn't show, but we can't make an independent judgment about that.
Right, and again, I'm not to regurgitate everything that's in the brief, but I mean, Judge Patrick, he was the trial court judge on this. His only reference to the video was, I think this sounds like a Judge Patrickism, that he said, well, he was really booking it out of the store.
Of course, that same evidence came in from the officer.
It came in through the officer, through loss prevention. There's two still photos that show him with his hair streaming behind him as he's leaving the store. So I think it's pretty clearly shown in the record that he ran out of the store.
Well, I get that. But again, getting back to my earlier point that the crime is arguably complete at some point in the store, and at least part of his actions in the store are on video, but we can't watch it. We don't have the benefit that Judge Patrick had. Now, he may not have put a whole lot of weight in it. We don't know that. He didn't specifically articulate how much weight he gave it. But from a sufficiency standpoint, we have to presume that unless he says otherwise, he seriously considered it as part of the equation. But we can't vet that. So.
Right. But, and that certainly, it's never is something that's occurred to me in the past. Now it's on my radar as far as making maybe foundation objections to evidence coming in and that sort of thing. I don't think in this case it's a particularly teed up well for the court to address.
That could well be. Might be worth a footnote. Maybe some trial judges get the message. But
right, I know I've had, just since this assignment of error was created, I've had a few public defenders reach out to me about this issue. So it clearly is an issue that's going on all over the place. But again, just bottom line here, it's a circumstantial case. I do think there's ambiguity here. I think his statement, take me back to the store, I'll show you where it is, the fact that the item's never recovered anywhere, somewhere, or whether, you know, inside the store, this thing just vaporized, you know, where there is ambiguity, it gets resolved in favor of the defendant. Where there's two reasonable theories, you can't arbitrarily select the one that incriminates, and the court's duty-bound to select the theory more consistent with innocence. I think there is a theory, a reasonable theory, consistent with innocence in this case, and for that reason, I would ask that you reverse and dismiss the conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Westenberg. Mr. Jones, how are you today?
Well, thank you. May it please the court, I am John Jones. I represent the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Mr. Cunningham's conviction because the evidence was sufficient. To the court's earlier point that it made, that the concealment was completed when Cunningham entered the bathroom with the box. You don't need a successfully completed larceny to uphold the concealment conviction. I think that's important in this case because obviously the parties went through at trial and recounted the entire sequence of events that occurred after that, including culminating the chase and Mr. Cunningham getting away and then being recovered eventually. But when Cunningham took that bag out of the box, hid it behind the bigger bag, and then entered the bathroom with it, he had concealed it from view of the rightful owner of Walmart, and at that point, willful concealment is prima facie evidence of intent to defraud. So you've got the intent and the action, and there was no evidence to rebut that was offered that prima facie case of concealment. So while
Mr. Jones, so your point about the intent is the fact that he didn't take it out and just misplace it in a different aisle of the store. He took it into a restroom where you're not allowed to take merchandise.
Yes, Your Honor, yeah. And at that point, that concealment was complete. And there were a host of suspicious activities that Mr. Cunningham went about, the first of which was definitely taking it out of the box, closing the box, putting the box back on the shelf, and then proceeding pretty directly to the bathroom with it, where, as Your Honor noted, and we've all been to Walmart, this wasn't in the record, but we've all been to Walmart, there's signs all over the place about not bringing merchandise into the bathroom.
That's not in the record. So.
I know. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Westendorf is experienced. Can we come up and dispute that?
It's still a suspicious circumstance. It's not, you know, and the trier of fact can use their common sense in evaluating that action. And then when he comes back out, both loss prevention officer Blake and loss prevention officer Luna Caban said that he didn't have the tank bag in his hand anymore when he came out of the bathroom, and then they maintained consistent visual contact with him until he left the store. The flight is certainly probative also of his state of mind. And opposing counsel had mentioned that the only evidence of why Cunningham fled was his statement to Officer Shank at the end, but I wanted to call the court's attention to some of Blake's testimony on page 30 of the appendix. She testified that she approached him and introduced herself and said, "Hi, my name is Kristen. I work for Walmart Loss Prevention. Do you mind stepping into this office to talk about the merchandise that you have concealed?" After I said those words, he took off from me, ran from me, and we all saw the photos at least of how that went. And
is it fair to say from the record that the point in time that he left the store and the officer lost him, that there would have been an opportunity to get rid of the bag?
Certainly, Your Honor.
He had it on him.
Shank lost sight of him for sure when he got away and got into the pawn shop shooting range bathroom. There was a period of time during which Cunningham was not under observation by any Walmart or law enforcement that he could have gotten rid of the bag in any number of places. And so the fact that he didn't have it on his person when he was picked up, and if he had wanted to tell Shank where the bag was, he certainly could have just told him. It wasn't necessary for him to bring him back to the store for him to show him. And he didn't, Shank's testimony was that he just didn't say anything else when he asked him to tell him where it was. So it wasn't a matter of, well, I can't tell you because I don't remember, but if I was there, I could show you. It was just didn't say anything else. But I think the trier of fact could listen to that testimony and determine, as I think Shanks was suspicious of, that this was just a further attempt to obfuscate and perhaps get an opportunity to get away.
Mr. Jones, I know that both sides, both parties here, have essentially said that this video is irrelevant. And but it does raise a larger issue down the road for the court and for counsel. You know, this was a Commonwealth's piece of evidence with proprietary software. Whose burden is it to make sure that it can be publicly viewed in a public record? Is it the party that introduces it into evidence, or is it the appellant?
That's a question that I think needs to probably be settled at the legislative level, to be honest, Your Honor, because I don't have any guidance on introducing exhibits that remain in publicly available format.
I beg to differ about that. I mean, certainly the legislature can weigh in on it if they choose, but admissibility issues are generally for the trial court and are arguably are something that maybe ought to be governed by the rules of court. And of course, appellate issues, insofar as they affect us, you know, are our business. And you know, and this may not be the case that we're going to have to deal with it, but at some point we are going to have to deal with a situation where, you know, a piece of evidence is crucial and we can't view it, and you know, nor can any member of the public if they ever choose to walk into a clerk's office and say, "I'd like to see the file in thus and such case or whatever," and which arguably they have a right to do unless it's sealed. So, I mean, there's a lot of both practical and even perhaps even constitutional issues that are in play here. And while the legislature can make all this very easy, I mean, I suspect we're going to have to deal with it as a judiciary long before they're going to have to deal with it as a legislature.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I suppose I misspoke. What I meant to more is that it's more of a policy issue that hasn't been settled by any precedent or authority that I could find, Your Honor. It's certainly a very important issue in this day and age of digital exhibits, and sometimes you'll have files that are password protected.
Well, I mean, all this is outside the record, but I happen to have some knowledge about such things, and it seems to me that it's not hard, even where you have proprietary, you know, protocols of one sort or another, whether it's, you know, for audio or video, to convert to a publicly, you know, available protocol that, you know, virtually anybody could can view it at will.
Certainly, Your Honor, I would concur with that. One thing that I would note is that what we do have is the law puts the burden on the appellant of preserving the appellate record to show to substantiate the error, and that goes to not only designating things and making sure they get into the record and making sure that they get into the appendix, but also at the trial level of making sure that objections are preserved.
Well, wait a minute, though.
And that
they're,
yes, Your Honor.
I do have a bit of a problem saying that it's the and I haven't really honed in on this as much as I'd like, because as you pointed out, there's not a whole lot out there, but it doesn't seem particularly fair from a policy standpoint, which we don't do, of course, but you're saying that if the Commonwealth introduces something into evidence that's proprietary, it then somehow shifts to the appellant's burden for purposes of appeal to make sure that that record, that is converted in the record, even though they don't really have access
to
the proprietary software that...
Yeah, and speaking anecdotally, I'm not sure that the Commonwealth has access to the proprietary software either. I think that it's a Walmart thing. At least in my experience of trying shoplifting cases, that's been the case.
So you can put a document in with invisible ink, show it to a jury, put it in the record, and then it's the defendant's burden to somehow... that invisible ink disappears.
And arguably, Mr. Westendorf satisfies that burden by simply designating that as part of the appendix. And, you know, he didn't put it into evidence. He's made what the trial court had, he's designated that as being available to us. And, you know, I mean, one possibility is that suddenly now it's our problem to figure out how we decipher all of this information. And, you know, and maybe that is the answer. I don't know. But that would certainly put a burden on us that's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to fulfill.
Yes, Your Honor, and I recognize that that is a difficulty. I'm not sure there's an easy answer. The only point I was trying to make is that the burden is on the appellant to preserve the record. You look at analogous situations like making a proffer of evidence that gets excluded. You have to make a proffer of it.
But they have the ability to do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
In this instance, I mean, I guess you're suggesting that at the point in time that the Commonwealth introduced it into evidence, the defendant asked that it be converted into the appropriate software so that it can be made a part of the record for appeal?
Well, I think probably the better way to go about it would be, and with a video of the defendant, this is evidence that they would be entitled to look at pretrial, so presumably they'd be able to know what kind of format it's in. And just to be able to tee it up to say, and again, this is
I'm going to respectfully suggest that perhaps, if I'd been the Commonwealth attorney, you know, in this case, I would have told Walmart, if you want us to prosecute your cases, we need to get the evidence in a way that can be viewed by the courts. And if you can't convert it, you better figure out a way. And I mean, that's, I think, the approach that probably needs to be taken with some of these companies. I'm pretty confident it isn't hard for them to do at all. They pretty much have to have that capability if they expect to have any kind of commercial relationship with any other company these days. So
absolutely, Your Honor, and I agree with all of that. I also concur with opposing counsel that I'm not sure that the issue is particularly well teed up in this case, where we do have
and we appreciate that. We've kind of gone far afield here, but our only point about this is that this is this was an issue that was raised by the court. And that should send a signal to everybody that it's out there, and as Mr. Westendorf pointed out, the PDs are acutely aware of it now, and the AG's office is acutely aware of it.
Well, and imagine, I mean, I'm sure I'm speaking for my colleagues, although I haven't discussed this with them, but when I first got this file, the argument is sufficiency of the evidence. Okay, let's look at the evidence. Well, what do you know? I can't look at all the evidence. It's just not available to me. So how do I decide a sufficiency case based purely on representations of counsel who are basically not under oath, you know, are making these arguments on appeal? I can't put myself in the position of the trial court, which is typically what we do in a sufficiency argument, and look at, okay, what was available to you to consider, and is, you know, does it support the conclusion you came to? You basically have told us you have to make that determination without looking at all the evidence the trial court looked at. So, you know, that's what kind of bothered us about this case and why we asked the parties to address it.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I wish that there was a better answer available, but as things stand right now, I just don't.
Well, it is what it is.
Well, I think both of you made sound arguments on the point, which is either way we can probably decide this case, but it is troubling that this kind of issue is lingering out there.
I certainly appreciate the court's point, and hopefully it'll be able to be
to the extent that you guys communicate with Commonwealth attorneys at all, you might want to pass the word too. I think Mr. Westendorf apparently has that ability with the public defender. So
absolutely, Your Honor. I would just call the court's attention, and I guess I would just rest on my brief for the remainder of the sufficiency argument. So.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Westendorf?
Just a few points that I had wanted to make. As far as the idea that entering the bathroom in and of itself constitutes a concealment, I'm not aware of any precedent that would stand for that proposition.
No, it wasn't the entering the bathroom. It was entering the bathroom with the object, coming out without the object.
Understood, although I don't think the record is clear that he came out of the bathroom without the object. They couldn't see it, but I don't know that it's firmly established.
They saw it going in and they didn't see it coming out.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. The second point that I wanted to make was, as far as the argument that loss prevention had maintained consistent visual contact with him throughout the process of leaving the store, I was just taking a look quickly back through the trial transcript on page 50 of the appendix. When I cross-examined the loss prevention officer, she acknowledged we lost visual contact with him multiple times as he was exiting the store, so there would have been ample opportunity for him to put the item down.
But they did go aisle by aisle.
There was testimony they went through trying to find the item and were unsuccessful. As far as the argument that, hey, you know, if Mr. Cunningham wanted to tell Officer Schenck where the item was located, he could have done so and he didn't. The testimony as far as that conversation was extremely murky. Officer Schenck did testify. I told him, hey, just tell me where it is. There was no testimony that Mr. Cunningham refused to respond or anything along those lines. I think it's unclear exactly what had happened there. I think it stands to reason it would make more sense for Mr. Cunningham in this 100,000 square foot store to actually go and show where he put it. I think it's difficult for him to describe in a store that cavernous exactly where he had placed the item down. Just again, very briefly, getting back to the video, I would wholeheartedly agree with what you had said, Judge Decker, as far as I think it puts the defense attorneys in a very difficult predicament to say that the burden is on us to preserve
the Commonwealth's
evidence, exactly. That's never in our custody and control. We might be able to view it, but that places an almost impossible burden on the defense attorneys.
It certainly would seem to me to be a sound basis for an objection.
I agree, and honestly, it's on my radar, and I think it would be a well-founded foundation objection going forward that appellate rights could potentially be chilled. So.
And as Judge Humphreys points out, oftentimes it's an easy fix if you have the person who created the DVD with the proprietary software to make it something that would be available in a record.
I agree.
With an appropriate objection or with the Commonwealth thinking of it in advance.
Right. And I think there's already going to be some pretrial motions forthcoming.
Well, we'll look forward to those then.
We won't get to see them.
But that otherwise, I would rely on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Westendorf. We'll come down to Greek Council and take up Tamara Felicia Brown against the Commonwealth.